Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw. Act 2. Next day, at 11 a.m., Higgins Laboratory in Wimpole Street. It is a room on the first floor looking on the street and was meant for the drawing room. The double doors are in the middle of the back hall, and persons entering find in the corner to their right two tall file cabinets at right angles to one another against the walls. In this corner stands a flat writing table, on which are a phonograph, a laryngoscope, a row of tiny organ pipes with a bellows, a set of lamp chimneys for singeing flames with burners attached to a gas plug in the wall by an india rubber tube, several tuning forks of different sizes, a life-size image of half a human head showing in section the vocal organs, and a box containing a supply of wax cylinders for the phonograph. Further down the room on the same side is a fireplace with a comfortable leather-covered easy chair at the side of the hearth nearest the door and a coal scuttle. There is a clock on the mantelpiece. Between the fireplace and the phonograph table is a stand for newspapers. On the other side of the central door to the left of the visitor is a cabinet of shallow drawers. On it is a telephone and the telephone directory. The corner beyond and most of the side wall is occupied by a grand piano with a keyboard at the end furthest from the door and a bench for the player extending the full length of the keyboard. On the piano is a dessert dish heaped with fruit and sweets, mostly chocolates. The middle of the room is clear. Besides the easy chair, the piano bench, and two chairs at the phonograph table, there is one stray chair. It stands near the fireplace. On the walls, engravings, mostly Piranesis and mezzotint portraits. No paintings. Pickering is seated at the table, putting down some cards and a tuning fork, which he has been using. Higgins is standing up near him, closing two or three file drawers which are hanging out. He appears in the morning light as a robust, vital, appetizing sort of man of 40 or thereabouts, dressed in a professional-looking black frock coat with a white linen collar and black silk tie. He is of the energetic, scientific type, heartily, even violently interested in everything that can be studied as a scientific subject, and careless about himself and other people, including their feelings. He is, in fact, but for his years and size, rather like a very impetuous baby, taking notice eagerly and loudly, and requiring almost as much watching to keep him out of unintended mischief. His manner varies from genial bullying, when he is in a good humour, to stormy petulance, when anything goes wrong. But he is so entirely frank and devoid of malice that he remains likable, even in his least reasonable moments. He speaks as he shuts the last drawer.
"Well, I think that's the whole show. It's really amazing. I haven't taken half of it in, you know. Would you like to go over any of it again?"
Pickering, rising and coming to the fireplace, where he plants himself with his back to the fire.
"No, thank you. Not now. I'm quite done up for this morning."
Higgins follows him and stands beside him on his left.
"Tired of listening to sounds?" "Yes, it's a fearful strain. I rather fancied myself because I can pronounce 24 distinct vowel sounds. But your 130 beat me. I can't hear a bit of difference between most of them."
Higgins chuckles, and going over to the piano, eats some sweets.
"Oh, that comes with practice. You hear no difference at first, but you keep on listening, and presently you find they're all as different as A from B."
At this point Mrs. Pierce looks in. She is Higgins' housekeeper.
"What's the matter?"
Mrs. Pierce, speaking hesitatingly and evidently perplexed.
"The young woman wants to see you, sir."
"A young woman? What does she want?"
"Well, sir, she says you'll be glad to see her when you know what she's come about. She's quite a common girl, sir, very common indeed. I should have sent her away, only I thought perhaps you wanted her to talk into your machines. I hope I've not done wrong. But really, you see such queer people sometimes. You'll excuse me, I'm sure, sir."
"Oh, that's all right, Mrs. Pierce. Has she an interesting accent?"
"Oh, something dreadful, sir, really. I don't know how you can take an interest in it."
Higgins turns to Pickering.
"Oh, let's have her up. Show her up, Mrs. Pierce."
He rushes across to his working table and picks out a cylinder to use on the phonograph. Mrs. Pierce, only half resigned to her task.
"Very well, sir. It's for you to say."
She goes downstairs.
"Well, this is rather a bit of luck.
I'll show you how I make records. We'll set her talking, and I'll take it down first in Bell's visible speech, then in Brodromic, and then we'll get her on the phonograph so that you can turn her on as often as you like with the written transcript before you. This is the young woman, sir.
The flower girl enters in state. She has a hat with three ostrich feathers, orange, sky blue, and red. She has a nearly clean apron, and the shoddy coat has been tidied a little. The pathos of this deplorable figure, with its innocent vanity and consequential air, touches Pickering, who has already straightened himself in the presence of Mrs. Pierce. But as to Higgins, the only distinction he makes between men and women is that, when he is neither bullying nor exclaiming to the heavens against some featherweight cross, he coaxes women as a child coaxes its nurse when it wants to get anything out of her. Higgins reacts briskly, recognizing her with unconcealed disappointment, and at once baby-like, making an intolerable grievance of it.
"Why, this is the girl I jotted down last night. She's no use. I've got all the records I want of Listen Grove lingo, and I'm not going to waste another cylinder on it. Be off with you. I don't want you." "Don't you be so saucy. You ain't heard what I come for yet."
Speaking to Mrs. Pierce, who is waiting at the door for further instruction,
"Did you tell him I come in a taxi?"
"Nonsense, girl. What do you think a gentleman like Mr. Higgins cares what you came in?"
"Oh, we are proud. He ain't above giving lessons, not him. I heard him say so." "Well, I ain't come here to ask for any compliment, and if my money's not good enough, I can go elsewhere."
"Good enough for what?"
"Good enough for you. Now you know, don't you? I've come to have lessons, I am, and to pay for 'em too, make no mistake."
"Well, what do you expect me to say to you?"
"Well, if you was a gentleman, you might ask me to sit down, I think. Don't I tell you I'm bringing you business?"
"Pickering, shall we ask this baggage to sit down, or shall we throw her out of the window?"
Oh, I won't be called a baggage when I've offered to pay like any lady."
Motionless, the two men in the room stare at her from the other side of the room, amazed. Pickering speaks.
"What is it you want, my girl?"
"I want to be a lady in a flower shop instead of selling at the corner of Tottenham Court Road. But they won't take me unless I can talk more genteel. He said he could teach me. Well, here I am, ready to pay him, not asking any favour, and he treats me as if I was dirt."
"How can you be such a foolish, ignorant girl as to think you could afford to pay Mr. Higgins?"
"Why shouldn't I? I know what lessons cost as well as you do, and I'm ready to pay."
"How much?"
The girl comes back to him triumphant.
"Now you're talking. I thought you'd come off it when you saw a chance of getting back a bit of what you chucked at me last night. You had a drop in, hadn't you? Sit down." "Oh, if you're going to make a compliment of it, sit down."
"Sit down, girl. Do as you're told."
Mrs. Pierce places the stray chair near the hearthrug between Higgins and Pickering and stands behind it, waiting for the girl to sit down.
"Oh!"
She stands up, half rebellious and half bewildered. Pickering speaks.
"Won't you sit down?"
"I don't mind if I do."
She sits down, and Pickering returns to the hearthrug.
"What's your name?"
"Liza Doolittle."
"Eliza, Elizabeth, Betsy, and Bess, they went to the woods to get a bird's nest. They found a nest with four eggs in it. They took one apiece and left three in it."
Pickering and Higgins laugh heartily at their own wit.
"Oh, don't be silly."
"You mustn't speak to the gentleman like that."
"Well, why won't he speak sensible to me?"
"Come back to business. How much do you propose to pay me for the lessons?"
"Oh, I know what's right. A lady friend of mine gets French lessons for 18 pence an hour from a real French gentleman. Well, you wouldn't have the face to ask me the same for teaching me my own language as you would for French. So I won't give more than a shilling. Take it or leave it."
Higgins walks up and down the room, rattling his keys and his cash in his pockets. "You know, Pickering, if you consider a shilling not as a simple shilling, but as a percentage of this girl's income, it works out as fully equivalent to 60 or 70 guineas from a millionaire."
"How so?"
"Well, figure it out. A millionaire has about £150 a day. She earns about, half a crown."
"Who told you I only?" she offers me 2/5 of her day's income for a lesson. 2/5 of a millionaire's income for a day would be somewhere about £60. It's handsome. By George, it's enormous. It's the biggest offer I ever had.
Eliza rises, terrified.
£60? What are you talking about? I never offered you £60. Where would I get?
Hold your tongue.
But I ain't got £60. Oh,
don't cry, you silly girl. Sit down. Nobody's going to touch your money.
Somebody's going to touch you with a broomstick if you don't stop snivelling. Sit down.
Eliza obeys slowly.
Oh, one would think it was my father.
If I decide to teach you, I'll be worse than two fathers to you. Here.
He offers her his silk handkerchief.
What's this for?
To wipe your eyes. To wipe any part of your face that feels moist. Remember, that's your handkerchief and that's your sleeve. Don't mistake the one for the other if you wish to become a lady in a shop.
Eliza, utterly bewildered, stares helplessly at him.
It's no use talking to her like that, Mr. Higgins. She doesn't understand you. Besides, you're quite wrong. She doesn't do it that way at all.
And she takes the handkerchief. Eliza snatches it back.
Here, you give me that handkerchief. He gave it to me, not to you.
Pickering laughs.
He did. I think it must be regarded as her property, Mrs. Pierce.
Mrs. Pierce resigns herself.
Serve you right, Mr. Higgins. Higgins, I'm interested. What about the ambassador's garden party? I'll say you're the greatest teacher alive if you make that good. I'll bet you all the expenses of the experiment you can't do it, and I'll pay for the lessons.
Oh, you are real good. Thank you, Captain.
Higgins looks at her, tempted.
It's almost irresistible. She's so deliciously low, so horribly dirty.
Liza protests extremely.
Oh, I ain't dirty. I wash my face and hands afore I come, I did.
You're certainly not going to turn her head with flattery, Higgins.
Mrs. Pierce responds uneasily.
Oh, don't say that, sir. There's more ways than one of turning a girl's head, and nobody can do it better than Mr. Higgins, though he may not always mean it. I do hope, sir, you won't encourage him to do anything foolish.
Higgins becomes excited as the idea grows on him.
What is life but a series of inspired follies? The difficulty is to find them to do. Never lose a chance. It doesn't come every day. I shall make a duchess of this draggle-tailed guttersnipe.
Eliza strongly deprecates this view of her.
Oh!
Higgins is carried away.
Yes, in 6 months, in 3 if she has a good ear and a quick tongue, I'll take her anywhere and pass her off as anything. We'll start today, now, this moment. Take her away and clean her, Mrs. Pierce. Monkey brand, if it won't come off any other way. Is there a good fire in the kitchen? Yes, sir, but take all her clothes off and burn them. Ring up Whiteley or somebody for new ones. Wrap her up in brown paper till they come.
You're no gentleman. You're not to talk of such things. I'm a good girl, I am, and I know what the like of you are, I do.
We want none of your Lisson Grove prudery here, young woman. You've got to learn to behave like a duchess. Take her away, Mrs. Pierce. If she gives you any trouble, wallop her.
Liza springs up and runs between Pickering and Mrs. Pierce for protection.
Now I'll call the police, I will.
But, sir, I've no place to put her. We'll put her in the dustbin.
Oh!
Oh, come, Higgins, be reasonable.
You must be reasonable, Mr. Higgins, really you must. You can't walk over everybody like this.
Higgins, thus scolded, subsides. The hurricane is succeeded by a zephyr of amiable surprise. And speaking with professional exquisiteness of modulation, Higgins replies,
I? Walk over everybody? My dear Mrs. Pierce, my dear Pickering, I never had the slightest intention of walking over anyone. All I propose is that we should be kind to this poor girl. We must help her to prepare and fit herself for her new station in life. If I did not express myself clearly, it was because I did not wish to hurt her delicacy. Or yours.
Eliza, reassured, steals back to her chair.
Well, did you ever hear anything like that, sir?
Pickering laughs heartily.
Never, Mrs. Pierce, never.
What's the matter?
Well, the matter is, sir, that you can't take a girl up like that as if you were picking up a pebble on the beach.
Why not?
Why not? But you don't know anything about her. What about her parents? She may be married.
Gone.
There. as the girl very properly says, gone. Married, indeed. Don't you know that a woman of that class looks a worn-out drudge of 50 a year after she's married? Who'd marry me?
Higgins, suddenly resorting to the most thrillingly beautiful low tones in his best elocutionary style.
By George, Eliza, the streets will be strewn with the bodies of men shooting themselves for your sake before I've done with you. Oh, nonsense, sir. You mustn't talk to her like that.
Eliza rises and squares away herself determinedly.
I'm going away. He's off as chumpy is. I don't want no balmies teaching me.
Higgins is wounded in his tenderest point by her insensibility to his elocution.
Oh, indeed. I'm mad, am I? Very well, Mrs. Pierce. You needn't order the new clothes for her. Throw her out. No, you got no right to touch me.
You see now what comes of being saucy?
She indicates the door.
This way, please.
Eliza at this point is almost in tears.
I didn't want no clothes. I wouldn't have taken them.
She throws away the handkerchief.
I can buy my own clothes.
Higgins, deftly retrieving the handkerchief and intercepting her on her reluctant way to the door.
You're an ungrateful, wicked girl. This is my return for offering to take you out of the gutter and dress you beautifully and make a lady of you.
Oh, stop, Mr. Higgins. I won't allow it. It's you that are wicked. Go home to your parents, girl, and tell them to take better care of you.
I ain't got no parents. They told me I was big enough to earn my own living and turn me out.
Where's your mother?
I ain't got no mother. Her that turned me out was my sick stepmother. But I done without them, and I'm a good girl, I am.
Very well, then. What on earth is all this fuss about? The girl doesn't belong to anybody, is no use to anybody but me. You can adopt her, Mrs. Pierce. I'm sure a daughter would be a great amusement to you. Now, don't make any more fuss. Take her downstairs and...
But what's to become of her? Is she to be paid anything? Do be sensible, sir.
Oh, pay her whatever is necessary. Put it down in the housekeeping book. What on earth will she want with money? She'll have her food and her clothes. She'll only drink if you give her money.
Eliza turns on him.
Oh, you are a brute. It's a lie. Nobody ever saw the sign of liquor on me.
She goes back to her chair and plants herself there defiantly. Pickering, in good-humoured remonstrance, speaks.
Does it occur to you, Higgins, that the girl has some feelings?
Higgins looks at her critically.
Oh, no, I don't think so. Not any feelings that we need bother about. Have you, Eliza? Got my feelings same as anyone else. Oh, you see the difficulty?
Oh, what difficulty?
To get her to talk grammar. The mere pronunciation is easy enough. I don't want to talk grammar. I want to talk like a lady.
Will you please keep to the point, Mr. Higgins? I want to know on what terms the girl is to be here. Is she to have any wages? And what is to become of her when you've finished your teaching? You must look ahead a little.
Higgins is impatient.
What's to become of her if I leave her in the gutter? Tell me that, Mrs. Pierce.
That's her own business, not yours, Mr. Higgins.
Well, when I've done with her, we can throw her back into the gutter, and then it will be her own business again, so that's all right.
Oh, you've got no feeling aught in you. You don't care for nothing but yourself.
She rises and takes the floor resolutely.
Here, I've had enough of this. I'm going.
And she makes for the door.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself, you ought.
Higgins snatches a chocolate cream from the piano, his eyes suddenly beginning to twinkle with mischief.
Have some chocolates, Eliza.
She halts, tempted.
How do I know what might be in them? I've heard of girls being drugged by the like of you.
Higgins whips out his penknife, cuts a chocolate in two, puts one half into his mouth and bolts it, and offers her the other half.
Pledge of good faith, Eliza. I eat one half, you eat the other.
Eliza opens her mouth to retort. He pops the half chocolate into it.
You shall have boxes of them, barrels of them, every day. You shall live on them, eh?
Liza, who has disposed of the chocolate after being nearly choked by it.
I wouldn't have ate it, only I'm too ladylike to take it out of me mouth.
Listen, Eliza, I think you said you came in a taxi.
Well, what if I did? I've as good a right to take a taxi as anyone else.
You have, Eliza, and in the future you shall have as many taxis as you want. You shall go up and down and round the town in a taxi every day. Think of that, Eliza.
Mr. Higgins, you're tempting the girl. It's not right. She should think of the future.
At her age, nonsense. Time enough to think of the future when you haven't any future to think of.
No, Eliza.
Do as this lady does. Think of other people's futures, but never think of your own. Think of chocolates.
and taxis, and gold, and diamonds. No, I don't want no gold and no diamonds. I'm a good girl, I am.
She sits down again with an attempt at dignity.
You shall remain so, Eliza, under the care of Mrs. Pierce, and you shall marry an officer in the Guards with a beautiful moustache, the son of a marquis who will disinherit him for marrying you, but will relent when he sees your beauty and goodness.
Excuse me, Higgins, but I really must interfere. Mrs. Pierce is quite right. If this girl is to put herself in your hands for 6 months for an experiment in teaching, she must understand thoroughly what she's doing.
How can she? She's incapable of understanding anything. Besides, do any of us understand what we are doing? If we did, would we ever do it?
Very clever, Higgins, but not sound sense.
He turns to Eliza.
Miss Doolittle.
Oh.
There. That's all you get out of Eliza.
Oh.
No use explaining. As a military man, you ought to know that. Give her her orders. That's what she wants. Eliza, you are to live here for the next 6 months, learning how to speak beautifully, like a lady in a florist's shop. If you're good, and do whatever you're told, you shall sleep in a proper bedroom, and have lots to eat, and money to buy chocolates, and take rides in taxis. If you're naughty and idle, you will sleep in the back kitchen among the black beetles, and be walloped by Mrs. Pierce with a broomstick. At the end of 6 months, you shall go to Buckingham Palace in a carriage beautifully dressed. If the king finds out you're not a lady, you will be taken by the police to the Tower of London, where your head will be cut off as a warning to other presumptuous flower girls. But if you are not found out, you shall have a present of 7 and 6 pence to start life with as a lady in a shop. If you refuse this offer, you will be a most ungrateful and wicked girl, and the angels will weep for you. Now, are you satisfied, Pickering? Can I put it more plainly and fairly, Mrs. Pierce?
Mrs. Pierce is patient.
I think you'd better let me speak to the girl properly in private. I don't know that I can take charge of her or consent to the arrangement at all. Of course, I know you don't mean her any harm, but when you get what you call interested in people's accents, you never think or care what may happen to them or you. Come with me, Eliza.
Oh, that's all right.
Thank you, Mrs. Pierce. Bundle her off to the bathroom.
Eliza rises reluctantly and suspiciously.
You're a great bully, you are. I won't stay here if I don't like. I won't let nobody wallop me. I never asked to go to Buckingham Palace. I didn't. I was never in trouble with the police. Not me. I'm a good girl.
Don't answer back, girl. You don't understand the gentleman. Come with me.
She leads the way to the door and holds it open for Eliza. And as she goes out, Eliza speaks.
Well, what I say is right. I won't go near the king, not if I'm going to have me head cut off. If I'd have known what I was letting myself in for, I wouldn't have come here. I've always been a good girl, and I never offered to say a word to him, and I don't owe him nothing, and I don't care, and I won't be put upon, and I have my feelings the same as anyone else.
Mrs. Pierce shuts the door, and Eliza's plaints are no longer audible. Pickering comes from the hearth to the chair and sits astride it with his arms on the back.
"Excuse the straight question, Higgins. Are you a man of good character where women are concerned?"
"Have you ever met a man of good character where women are concerned?"
"Yes, very frequently."
Higgins dogmatically lifts himself on his hands to the level of the piano and sits on it with a bounce.
"Well, I haven't. I find that the moment I let a woman make friends with me, she becomes jealous, exacting, suspicious, and a damned nuisance. I find that the moment I let myself make friends with a woman, I become selfish and tyrannical. Women upset everything. When you let them into your life, you find that the woman is driving at one thing, and you're driving at another."
"That's what, for example?"
"Oh, Lord knows, I suppose the woman wants to live her own life, and the man wants to live his, and each tries to drag the other on to the wrong track. One wants to go north and the other south, and the result is that they both have to go east, though they both hate the east wind."
Higgins sits down on the bench at the keyboard.
"So here I am, a confirmed old bachelor, and likely to remain so."
Pickering rises and stands over Higgins gravely.
"Come, Higgins, you know what I mean. If I'm to be in this business, I shall feel responsible for that girl. I hope it's understood that no advantage is to be taken of her position."
"What? That thing?
Sacred, I assure you. You see, she'll be a pupil, and teaching would be impossible unless pupils were scared. I've taught scores of American millionaires how to speak English. The best-looking women in the world. I'm seasoned. They might as well be blocks of wood. I might as well be a block of wood.
At this point, Mrs. Pierce opens the door. She has Eliza's hat in her hand. Pickering retires to the easy chair at the hearth and sits down.
Well, Mrs. Pierce, is it all right?
I just wish to trouble you with a word, if I may, Mr. Higgins.
Yes, certainly, come in.
She comes forward.
Don't burn that, Mrs. Pierce. I'll keep it as a curiosity.
He takes the hat.
Handle it carefully, sir, please. I had to promise her not to burn it, but I had better put it in the oven for a while.
Higgins puts it down hastily on the piano.
Oh, thank you. Well, what have you to say to me? Am I in the way? Not at all, sir. Mr. Higgins, will you please be very particular what you say before the girl? Of course. I'm always particular about what I say. Why do you say this to me? No, sir. You're not at all particular when you've mislaid anything or when you get a little impatient. Now, it doesn't matter before me. I'm used to it. But you really must not swear before the girl.
I? Swear? I never swear. I detest the habit. What the devil do you mean?
That's what I mean, sir. You swear a great deal too much. I don't mind your damning and blasting and what the devil and where the devil and who the devil.
Really? Mrs. Pierce, this language from your lips.
But there is a certain word I must ask you not to use. The girl has just used it herself because the bath was too hot. It begins with the same letter as bath. She knows no better. She learnt it at her mother's knee, but she must not hear it from your lips.
I cannot charge myself with having ever uttered it, Mrs. Pierce.
But she looks at him steadfastly. He adds, hiding an uneasy conscience with a judicial air,
except perhaps in a moment of extreme and justifiable excitement. Only this morning, sir, you applied it to your boots, to the butter, and to the brown bread.
Oh, that! A mere alliteration, Mrs. Pierce, natural to a poet.
Well, sir, whatever you choose to call it, I beg you not to let the girl hear you repeat it.
Oh, very well, very well. Is that all?
No, sir. We shall have to be very particular with this girl as to personal cleanliness.
Certainly.
Quite right, most important.
I mean not to be slovenly about her dress or untidy in leaving things about.
Higgins goes to her solemnly.
Just so. I intended to call your attention to that.
He passes on to Pickering, who is enjoying the conversation immensely.
It is these little things that matter, Pickering. Take care of the pence, and the pounds will take care of themselves, is as true of personal habits as of money.
He comes to anchor on the hearthrug with the air of a man in an unassailable position.
Yes, sir. Then might I ask you not to come down to breakfast in your dressing gown, or at any rate not to use it as a napkin to the extent you do, sir? And if you would be so good as not to eat everything off the same plate, and to remember not to put the porridge saucepan out of your hand on the clean tablecloth, it would be a better example to the girl. You know, you nearly choked yourself with a fishbone in the jam only last week.
Higgins is routed from the hearthrug and drifts back to the piano.
I may do these things sometimes in absence of mine, but surely I don't do them habitually. By the way, my dressing gown smells most damnably of benzene.
No doubt it does, Mr. Higgins, but if you will wipe your fingers...
Oh, very well, very well. I'll wipe them in my hair in future.
I hope you're not offended, Mr. Higgins.
Higgins is shocked at finding himself thought capable of an unamiable sentiment.
Not at all, not at all. You're quite right, Mrs. Pierce. I shall be particularly careful before the girl. Is that all?
No, sir.
Might she use some of those Japanese dresses you brought from abroad? I really can't put her back into her own things.
Certainly. Anything you like. Is that all?
Thank you, sir.
That's all. Mrs. Pierce goes out.
You know, Pickering, that woman has the most extraordinary ideas about me. Here I am, a shy, diffident sort of man. I've never been able to feel really grown up and tremendous like other chaps, and yet she is firmly persuaded that I'm an arbitrary, overbearing, bossing kind of person. I can't account for it.
Mrs. Pierce returns.
If you please, sir, the trouble's beginning already. There's a dustman downstairs. Alfred Doolittle wants to see you. He says you have his daughter here.
Phew, I say.
Pickering retreats to the hearthrug.
Send the blackguard up.
Oh, very well, sir. And she goes out.
He may not be a blackguard, Higgins. Nonsense, of course he's a blackguard. Whether he is or not, I'm afraid we shall have some trouble with him.
Oh, no, I think not. If there's any trouble, he shall have it with me, not I with him. And we are sure to get something interesting out of him.
About the girl?
No, I mean his dialect.
Oh.
Mrs. Pierce comes to the door.
Doolittle, sir.
She admits Doolittle and retires. Alfred Doolittle is an elderly but vigorous dustman, clad in the costume of his profession, including a hat with a back brim covering his neck and shoulders. He has well-marked and rather interesting features, and seems equally free from fear and conscience. He has a remarkably expressive voice, the result of a habit of giving vent to his feelings without reserve. His present pose is that of a wounded honor and stern resolution. Doolittle is at the door, uncertain which of the two gentlemen is his man.
"Professor Higgins?"
"Here."
"Good morning. Sit down."
"Morning, Governor."
He sits down magisterially.
"I come about a very serious matter, Governor."
Higgins speaks to Pickering.
"Brought up in Hounslow. Mother Welsh, I should think."
Doolittle opens his mouth, amazed. Higgins continues. "What do you want, Doolittle?"
"I want my daughter. That's what I want, see?"
"Of course you do. You're her father, aren't you? You don't suppose anyone else wants her, do you? I'm glad to see that you have some spark of family feeling left. She's upstairs. Take her away at once."
Doolittle rises, fearfully taken aback.
"What? Take her away. Do you suppose I'm going to keep your daughter for you?"
"Now, now, look here, Governor. Is this reasonable? Is it fair to take advantage of a man like this? The girl belongs to me, you got her. Where do I come in?"
He sits down again.
"Your daughter had the audacity to come to my house and ask me to teach her how to speak properly so that she could get a place in a flower shop. This gentleman and my housekeeper have been here all the time. How dare you come here and attempt to blackmail me? You sent her here on purpose."
"No, Governor. You must have. How else could you possibly know that she is here?"
"Oh, don't take a man up like that, Governor. The police shall take you up. This is a plant, a plot to extort money by threats. I shall telephone for the police."
He crosses resolutely to the telephone and opens the directory.
"Have I asked you for a brass farthing? I leave it to the gentleman here. Have I said a word about money?"
Higgins throws the book aside and marches down on Doolittle with a poser.
"What else did you come for?"
"Well, what would a man come for? Be human, Governor."
Higgins is disarmed.
"Alfred, did you put her up to it?"
"So help me, Governor. I never did. Or take my Bible oath, I ain't seen the girl these 2 months past."
"Then how did you know she was here?"
Doolittle speaking very musically and melancholy.
"I'll tell you, Governor, if you'll only let me get a word in. I'm willing to tell you. I'm wanting to tell you. I'm waiting to tell you."
"Pickering, this chap has a certain natural gift of rhetoric. Observe the rhythm of his native wood notes wild. I'm willing to tell you. I'm wanting to tell you. I'm waiting to tell you. Sentimental rhetoric. That's the Welsh strain in him. It also accounts for his mendacity and dishonesty."
"Oh, please, Higgins. I'm West Country myself."
Pickering turns to Doolittle.
"How did you know the girl was here if you didn't send her?"
"Oh, it was like this, Governor. The girl took a boy in the taxi to give him a jaunt. Son of her landlady, he is. He hung about on the chance of giving him another ride home. Well, she sent him back for her luggage when she heard you was willing for her to stop here. I met the boy at the corner of Longacre and Endell Street."
"Public house, yes."
"The poor man's club. Governor, why shouldn't I?"
"Oh, do let him tell his story, Higgins."
"He told me what was up, and I asked you, what was my feelings and my duty as a father? I says to the boy, 'You bring me the luggage,' I says."
"Why didn't you go for it yourself?"
"Landlady wouldn't have trusted me with her, Governor. She's that kind of a woman, you know. I had to give the boy a penny afore he trusted me with it, the little swine. I brought it to her just to oblige you, like, and make myself agreeable, that's all."
"How much luggage?"
"Musical instrument, Governor. A few pictures, a trifle of jewellery, and a birdcage. She says she didn't want no clothes. What was I to think from that, Governor? I ask you, as a parent, what was I to think?"
"So you came to rescue her from worse than death, eh?"
"Just so, Governor. That's right."
But why did you bring her luggage if you intended to take her away?
Have I said a word about taking her away? Have I now?
You're going to take her away double quick.
He crosses to the hearth and rings the bell.
No, Governor. Don't say that. I'm not the man to stand in my girl's light. Here's a career opening for her, as you might say, and...
Mrs. Pierce opens the door and awaits orders.
Mrs. Pierce, this is Eliza's father. He has come to take her away. Give it to him.
He goes back to the piano with an air of washing his hands of the whole affair.
Now, this is a misunderstanding. Listen here.
He can't take her away, Mr. Higgins. How can he? You told me to burn her clothes.
That's right. I can't carry the girl through the street like a blooming monkey, can I? I put it to you.
You have put it to me that you want your daughter. Take your daughter. If she has no clothes, go out and buy her some.
Where's the clothes she come in? Did I burn them, or did you, Mrs. here?
I am the housekeeper, if you please. I have sent for some clothes for your girl. When they come, you can take her away. You can wait in the kitchen. This way, please.
Doolittle, much troubled, accompanies her to the door, then hesitates, finally turns confidentially to Higgins.
Listen here, Governor. You and me as men of the world, ain't we?
Oh, men of the world, are we? You'd better go, Mrs. Pierce.
I think so indeed, sir.
She goes with dignity.
The floor is yours, Mr. Doolittle. I thank you, Governor.
He turns to Higgins, who takes refuge on the piano bench, a little overwhelmed by the proximity of his visitor, for Doolittle has a professional flavor of dust about him.
Well, truth is, I've taken sort of a fancy to you, Governor. And if you want the girl, I'm not so set on having her back home again, but what I might be open to an arrangement. Regarded in the light of a young woman, she's a fine, handsome girl. As a daughter, she's not worth her keeping, so I tell you straight. All I ask is me rights as a father, and you're the last man alive to expect me to let her go for nothing, for I can see you're one of the straight sort, Governor. Well, what's a £5 note to you? And what's Eliza to me?
He returns to his chair and sits down judicially.
I think you ought to know, Doolittle, that Mr. Higgins' intentions are entirely honourable.
Course they are, Governor. If I thought they wasn't, I'd ask 50.
Higgins is revolted.
Do you mean to say, you callous rascal, that you would sell your daughter for £50?
Or not in general way, I wouldn't. But to oblige a gentleman like you, I'd do a good deal, I do assure you that. Have you no morals, man?
Nah.
Can't afford them, Governor. Neither could you if you was as poor as me. Not that I mean any harm, you know, but if Liza's going to have a bit out of this, why not me too?
I don't know what to do, Pickering. There can be no question that, as a matter of morals, it's a positive crime to give this chap a farthing, and yet I feel a sort of rough justice in his claim.
That's it, Governor. That's all I say. A father's heart, as it were. Well, I know the feeling, but really it seems hardly right. Don't say that, Governor. Don't look at it that way. What am I, Governess? Both? I ask you, what am I? I'm one of the undeserving poor, that's what I am. Think of what that means to a man. It means that he's up again middle-class morality all the time. If there's anything going and I put in for a bit of it, it's always the same story. You're undeserving, so you can't have it. But my needs is as great as the most deserving widow that's ever got money out of 6 different charities in 1 week for the death of the same husband. I don't need less than a deserving man, I need more. I don't eat less hearty than him, and I drink a lot more. I want a bit of amusement, 'cause I'm a thinking man. I want cheerfulness and a song and a band when I feel low. Well, they charge me just the same for everything as they charge the deserving. What is middle-class morality? Just an excuse for never giving me anything. Therefore, I ask you as 2 gentlemen not to play that game on me. I'm playing straight with you. I ain't pretending to be deserving. I'm undeserving, and I mean to go on being undeserving. I like it, and that's the truth. Will you take advantage of a man's nature to do him out of the price of his own daughter, what he's brought up and fed and clothed by the sweat of his brow until she's grown up big enough to be interesting to you 2 gentlemen? Is £5 unreasonable? I put it to you, and I leave it to you.
Higgins rises and crosses to Pickering.
Pickering, if we were to take this man in hand for 3 months, he could choose between a seat in the cabinet and a popular pulpit in Wales.
What do you say to that, Doolittle?
Not me, Governor. Thank you kindly. I've heard all the preachers and all the prime ministers, for I'm a thinking man and game for politics or religion or social reform, same as all the other amusements, and I tell you, it's a dog's life any way you look at it. Undeserving poverty is my line.
taken one station in society with another, it's... Well, it's the only one that has any ginger in it to my taste. I suppose we must give him a fiver. He'll make bad use of it, I'm afraid. Oh, not me, Governor, so help me, I won't. Don't you be afraid that I'll save it and spare it and live idle on it. There won't be a penny of it left by Monday. I'll have to go to work same as if I'd never had it. It won't pauperise me, you bet. Just one good spree for myself and the missus, giving pleasure to ourselves and employment to others, and satisfaction to you to think that it's not been thrown away. You couldn't spend it better.
Higgins takes out his pocketbook and comes between Doolittle and the piano. Oh, this is irresistible. Let's give him 10. He offers 2 notes to the dustman.
No, no, Governor. She wouldn't have the heart to spend 10, and perhaps I shouldn't either. £10 is a lot of money. It makes a man feel prudent-like, and then goodbye to happiness. You give me what I ask you, Governor. Not a penny more, and not a penny less. Why don't you marry that missus of yours? I rather draw the line at encouraging that sort of immorality. Tell her so, Governor. Tell her so, I'm willing. It's me that suffers by it. I've no hold on her. I've got to be agreeable to her. I've got to give her presents. I've got to buy her clothes something sinful. I'm a slave to that woman, Governor, just because I'm not her lawful husband, and she knows it too. Catch her marrying me. Oh, take my advice, Governor. Marry Eliza while she's young, and don't know no better. If you don't, you'll be sorry for it after. If you do, she'll be sorry for it after, but better you than her, because you're a man and she's only a woman and don't know how to be happy anyhow.
Pickering, if we listen to this man another minute, we shall have no convictions left.
£5, I think you said?
Thank you kindly, Governor.
You're sure you won't take 10?
Not now. Another time, Governor.
Higgins hands him the £5 note.
Here you are. Thank you, Governor. Good morning.
He hurries to the door, anxious to get away with his booty. When he opens it, he is confronted with a dainty and exquisitely clean young Japanese lady in a simple blue cotton kimono printed cunningly with small white jasmine blossoms. Mrs. Pierce is with her. He gets out of her way deferentially and apologizes.
Oh, beg pardon, miss.
The Japanese lady responds.
Go on. Don't know your own daughter. Blimey! It's Eliza!
Higgins, simultaneously.
What's that?
This! By Jove! Don't I look silly?
Silly?
Now, Mr. Higgins, please, don't say anything to make the girl conceited about herself.
Oh, quite right, Mrs. Pierce.
Yes, damned silly.
Please, sir.
I mean, extremely silly.
I should look all right with my hat on.
She takes up her hat, puts it on, and walks across the room to the fireplace with a fashionable air.
A new fashion, by George, and it ought to look horrible.
Doolittle speaks up with fatherly pride.
Well, I never thought she'd clean up as good as looking as that, Governor. She's a credit to me, ain't she? I tell you, it's easy to clean up here. Hot and cold water on tap, just as much as you like there is. Woolly towels there is, and a towel horse so hard it burns your fingers. Soft brushes to scrub yourself on a wooden bowl of soap smelling like primroses.
Now I know why ladies are so clean. Washing's a treat for them. Wish they saw what it is for the like of me.
I'm glad the bathroom met with your approval.
Oh, it didn't. Not all of it. And I don't care who hears me say it. Mrs. Pierce knows.
What was wrong, Mrs. Pierce?
Oh, nothing, sir. It doesn't matter.
I had a good mind to break it. I didn't know which way to look, but I hung a towel over it, I did.
Over what?
Over the looking-glass, sir.
Doolittle, you have brought your daughter up too strictly.
Me? I never brought her up at all, except to give her a lick of a strap now and again. Don't put it on me, Governor. She ain't accustomed to it, you see. That's all. But you'll soon pick up your free and easy ways.
I'm a good girl, I am, and I won't pick up no free and easy ways.
Eliza, if you say again that you're a good girl, your father shall take you home.
Not him. You don't know my father. All he come here for was to touch you for some money to get drunk on. Well, what else would I want money for? To put into the plate in church, I suppose.
She sticks her tongue out at him. He is so incensed by this that Pickering presently finds it necessary to step between them.
Don't you give me none of your lip. And don't let me hear you giving this gentleman any of it either, or you'll hear from me about it, say?
Have you any further advice to give her before you go, Doolittle? Your blessing, for instance?
No, Governor, I ain't such a mug as to put up my children to all I know myself. All enough to hold them in without that. If you want Eliza's mind improved, Governor, you do it yourself with a strap.
So long, gentlemen.
He turns to go. Higgins says impressively,
Stop. You'll come regularly to see your daughter. It's your duty, you know. My brother is a clergyman, and he could help you in your talks with her.
Certainly. I'll come, Governor. Not just this week, because I have a job at a distance, but later on you may depend on me. Afternoon, gentlemen. Afternoon, ma'am.
He takes off his hat to Mrs. Pierce, who disdains the salutation and goes out. He winks at Higgins, thinking him probably a fellow sufferer from Mrs. Pierce's difficult disposition, and follows her.
Don't you believe the old liar? He'd as soon you set a bulldog on him as a clergyman. You won't see him again in a hurry.
I don't want to, Eliza. Do you?
Not me. I don't want never to see him again. I don't. He's a disgrace to me, he is, collecting dust instead of working at his trade.
What is his trade, Eliza? Talking money out of other people's pockets into his own. His proper trade's a navy, and he works at it sometimes, too, for exercise, and earns good money at it. Ain't you going to call me Miss Doolittle any more?
I beg your pardon, Miss Doolittle. It was a slip of the tongue.
Oh, I don't mind, only it sounded so genteel. I should just like to take a taxi to the corner of Tottenham Court Road and get out there and tell it to wait for me, just to put the girls in their place a bit. I wouldn't speak to them, you know.
Better wait till we get you something really fashionable.
Besides, you shouldn't cut your old friends now. That you have risen in the world, that's what we call snobbery.
Oh, you don't call the like of them my friends now, I should hope. They've took it out of me often enough with their ridicule when they had the chance, and now I mean to get a bit of my own back. But if I'm to have fashionable clothes, I'll wait. I should like to have some. Mrs. Pierce says you're going to give me some to wear in bed at night, different to what I wear in the daytime. But it do seem a waste of money when you could get something to show. Besides, I never could fancy changing into cold things on a winter night.
Mrs. Pierce returns.
Now, Eliza, the new things have come for you to try on.
Ow!
And she rushes out. Mrs. Pierce follows her.
Oh, don't rush about like that, girl.
Pickering, we have taken on a stiff job.
Higgins, we have. The end of Act Two of Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw. Read by Rick Kirshner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.